Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning radio program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. We are, as always, brought to you by our loyal sponsor, The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, since 1980. The place to go for fabulous breakfast and lunch options, as well as all your catering requirements. The Marketplace. I should also add, for those of you keeping score at home, that today brings us the one-year anniversary of the arrival of Hurricane Helene to Western North Carolina. That would have been the 27th of September, 2024. And here we are. I also want to mention, coming up later in the show today, we will have a conversation with Jonathan Butcher, Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation, author of the book, The Polarization Myth, which is coming out later this year. And the title is self-explanatory. He believes, he more than believes, research and analysis have concluded that our nation is not nearly as polarized as the left-wing media would have us believe, especially on several very key topics. So we will be talking to Jonathan later in the program. He's coming here to Pinehurst on October the 8th as a speaker in the Holzhauser Speaker Series. If you'd like to buy tickets to see him speak, head on over to jhspeakerseries.com, where you can buy your tickets to see Jonathan on October 8th here in Pinehurst. I believe that will be at the Country Club of North Carolina. It is time, as we do each week, to anoint our public enemy number one. This guy may be a repeat offender. I have a feeling I didn't go back and check, but this week's public enemy number one, hands down, is the governor, the failed governor of California, Gavin Newsom. Now, here's a guy who, of course, stood by as large swaths of Southern California burned to the ground last December. Here's a guy who has no problem with the idea that shoplifting should be illegal only after you shoplift a certain amount of stuff. And now,
wait, and probably even more relevant to this is he's the guy who sent armed people after citizens who would not mask during COVID-19.
Correct.
Like would send, officers out to take people out of the ocean for not wearing a mask.
Or just walking along a beautiful beach.
Yes.
He actually did that. You're right. I'm glad you reminded me of that. So the governor Newsom, who thinks he's running for president in 2028, has signed into law a ban on the wearing of face coverings by law enforcement in California, specifically targeting immigrations and custom enforcement officers who, of course, have been doing the Lord's work across the fruited plain in rounding up illegal immigrants and getting them the heck out of our country. But Gavin thinks these guys are bad news, and he wants all their faces to be on full display so that they can then be targeted, as well as members of their family be targeted, by crazy people. And if you want to know whether or not that's a legitimate fear or not, look no further than what happened this past week in Dallas, when a lunatic, glassy-eyed, mentally ill young man took shots at an ICE detainment facility in the Dallas area, killing one person. And then, of course, as they often do, he turned his gun on himself. But let's hear the vitriol of Gavin Newsom. Let's play clip one.
That's Trump's America, but it is not the America we've grown up in. And so we're pushing back against this. For so many of you in Los Angeles, we talk about authoritarianism. Some think we're being hyperbolic. Depends the lens you see the world. Which set of eyes? For someone like me, I may not be experiencing it, but for many folks you see behind me, they have experienced it. There was a young man who's here as an advisor to the superintendent we just met with. He says, you don't need to touch the flame to feel the burn. The impact of these policies all across this city, our state and nation, are terrifying. It's like a dystopian sci-fi movie. Unmarked cars, people en masse, people quite literally disappearing, no due process, no rights in a democracy where we have rights. Immigrants have rights, and we have the right to stand up and push back. And that's what we're doing here today. This is a disgrace. This is an outrage, what we have allowed to happen in this country. And I could not be more proud of this legislature, the legislative authors, to the community demanding more from all of us at this moment to push back. I'll be signing a bill, the first in the nation, saying enough. ICE, unmask. What are you afraid of? What are you afraid of?
We're afraid of you, you left-wing anarchist.
What are you afraid of?
Doxing and going after their families and murdering their families as they wake up in the
you're
morning
gonna go or out
get
and
home. That's what
you're
we're
gonna
afraid
do enforcement?
Of.
Provide an ID. Tell us which agency you represent. Provide us basic information that all local law enforcement is required to provide.
I think they do provide that information, but not during a riot. You know, yeah. Federal agents do carry IDs, and if they come up and knock on your door, they present it. But if you're in the middle of a riot and people are throwing bricks at them, they don't pull out their ID. This guy's a clown. This guy's inciting all this violence. For a decade, Mr. Hairgel and his ilk have been calling Nazi, Nazi, Nazi. Anyone who's like to the right of Stalin, they've been calling a Nazi, right?
Yeah, and did you notice how he made a point of saying that this may not be affecting someone like me, as if giving him sort of a godlike aura.
Well, he's you know, he's also going around. I try not to listen to him, but occasionally some quality show like ours will play a news clip, right? And you just gotta listen. But you know, he's like spreading stuff like, I don't think there's going to be elections in 2028, right? Like, these are the people who called us election deniers, and he's going around saying there's not going to be election, causing their unhinged, mentally ill leftists to take up arms and start shooting at, like, you know, ICE agents, Charlie Kirk. I mean, this is the rhetoric that's stirring up all this.
And we saw it in Dallas.
No elections. Look, if President Trump said, I don't think there's going to be elections in 2028, the legacy media would go nuts.
Yeah.
But there he is saying it, and the legacy media, no one asked him, really? You really think there's not going to be? I mean, there is no sane person on this planet doesn't think that there's not going to be elections in 2028. But there he is spreading it specifically to incite people.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, by the way, we want elections because we like to see how big the margin of victory
right.
is going
to
be.
I want to see this guy. I'm looking for, in fact, we want the 2028 elections just to watch this guy get soundly defeated.
Well, and he may be facing, well, we don't know how it's all going to shake out, but the man he may be facing, Vice President J.D. Vance, was having none of it. Play clip two.
And I think that is the most disgusting thing. The very people who keep us safe ought to be honored and protected and praised by Democrats and Republicans alike. It is time to stop the rhetorical assault on law enforcement. Because here's what happened. Because here's what happens when Democrats like Gavin Newsom did say that these people are part of an authoritarian government. When the left-wing media lies about what they're doing, when they lie about who they're arresting, when they lie about the actual job of law enforcement, what they're doing is encouraging crazy people to go and commit violence. You don't have to agree with my immigration policies. You don't have to agree with Donald Trump's immigration policies. But if your political rhetoric encourages violence against our law enforcement, you can go straight to hell and you have no place in the political conversation of the United States of America.
Boy, hell is going to be crowded at this rate, I'll tell you that much.
So, you know, one thing he talked about, one thing that my fellow Marine J.D. Vance talked about there was misinformation about what law enforcement and agents are doing. I saw Kristi Noem on the show. Speaking of Kristi Noem, I stood next to her in an elevator once.
Really?
Yes, I should have gotten her phone number.
Was she wearing a lovely cologne, Chanel No. 5, perhaps?
I didn't notice.
Oh, okay.
I did notice that she's not super tall. She's,
no.
You know, I don't know, maybe 5'8".
But
five,
she's
six.
Bad to the bone.
She is. Yeah. She is exceeding everyone's expectations. Anyway, I saw her on a show the other day, and she mentioned that that DHS was having to do 10 to 12 corrections per day via their social media, where the legacy media is intentionally lying about what they do. The legacy media comes out and says they plucked this illegal alien right out of his job in broad daylight and they whisked him off, just like what Newsom was doing, right? DHS has to come back and say, you know, such and such, such and such was apprehended under a warrant for murder. And he's also, you know, an illegal alien. It's just crazy the amount of misinformation that the legacy. She has to do 10 to 12 corrections where the legacy media is intentionally lying about what those agents are doing. It's despicable.
Yeah, and I, you know, not to parse things too much, but I really detest the terms misinformation and disinformation, because really what they are lies, and they are deception to the core, and that's all there really is to it. So we've told you all about Public Enemy number one, but this week we have a special category that we're adding to the roster.
Yes.
Public Idiot number one.
And there's no shortage of those.
There aren't. And
it was like a 4,000 tie for first place.
Yeah, I think we might have to make this a regular part of the show. I kind of like it.
It was more difficult. It was more difficult than calculating the scores of the valedictorian for Moore County Schools, because, you know, Libby Carter couldn't possibly do that. So her and Calcutt had to do away with valedictorians and salutatorians because it was so difficult to calculate that score.
Exactly. Yeah, too much.
Sorry, I had to get a kidney shot in there.
No, that's okay. Maybe a groin shot, too. Public Idiot number one is Violet Affleck. She is the daughter of a guy who's a pretty good movie producer and actor, Ben Affleck, and is married to a lovely, seemingly normal woman, Jennifer Garner. I couldn't think of a more all-American woman than Jennifer Garner. But they teamed up to procreate a creature called Violet Affleck.
Yes.
And Violet is very concerned that we've all forgotten about COVID-19, and that we're not talking about it night and day, and that we're not sheltering in place and staying home, and of course, more than anything, that we're not wearing masks 24/7. She even went all the way to the United Nations to make her case. Play clip three.
And we are told by leaders across the board that we are the future. But when it comes to the ongoing pandemic, our present is being stolen right in front of our eyes. For adults, the relentless beat of back to normal, ignoring, downplaying, and concealing both the prevalence of airborne transmission and the threat of long COVID, manifested in a series of choices. Young people lacked both real choice in the matter and information about what was being chosen for us.
Wow, Violet, you're certainly wilting on the vine there. It sounds like to me. Did you notice she called it the ongoing pandemic?
Yes. So I'm just glad that she isn't the future, and I'm glad they didn't consult her. That was her complaints, is that, you know, she's the future and they didn't consult her. I'm glad that someone has to tell her she is not the future, and we're happy they didn't consult her. But, you know, long COVID, let's talk about it. So first of all, you're right. I mean, anyone who's concerned about COVID, and she was wearing a mask, and I read somewhere that she's been wearing a mask for 5 years. She is mentally ill.
Apparently, yes. And I wish that her parents would get help for her. But.
And then her concern about long COVID, someone also needs to tell her that if you don't want to get long COVID, then don't get the vax.
Yeah.
Because everyone, the vax is what caused long COVID. Everyone, I mean, I'm not vaccinated. I know lots of people to get vaccinated. And guess what we don't have?
Yeah.
Long COVID. COVID just came and went, just like, you know, the flu comes and goes. And,
yeah. Even midterm or medium COVID.
Right.
None of those COVID.
Right. Just, I had like everyone else, I had the 36-hour COVID.
Yeah, it's the best kind.
You know, and then like a brain fog for like a month. But COVID came and went and like, a day, 2 days.
Yeah, of course, because that's all it ever was a another form of a cold. Well, speaking of a pandemic like problem, we have that all across the state of North Carolina, but especially in our cities that are run by Democrats, such as Charlotte, where of course people were talking about Charlotte. For days and days on end after the brutal stabbing and murder of a beautiful Ukrainian refugee named Irina Zatarushka, 23 years old. And so the time had come for serious lawmakers to have serious discussions about crime. And, of course, I don't think there's any city in North Carolina that has the rampant chronic crime that we're seeing in so many other large cities. But, you know, it's not as though, you know, it's a paradise without any of it, because obviously this young lady lost her life on a light rail train. So the Republican members of the House and Senate in Raleigh got to work on a new crime bill. They named it Irina's Law, appropriately, and it has now passed through both the House and the Senate rather resoundingly. Of course, there were a bunch of Democrats who didn't want anything to do with it. They were revolted by the idea that there was discussion about how we can bring back a more reliable use of the death penalty, which has not occurred in this state in 19 years. The bill makes bail, cashless bail, a thing of the past, we hope, and takes the discretion regarding bail from magistrates in violent cases, and requires instead that the charged appear before a judge to negotiate bail. And then those magistrates who do mishandle bail decisions will be suspended until they figure out how to do their jobs. And also, again, revives the option of the death penalty in extreme cases, such as the guy stabbing a beautiful Ukrainian young woman on a train. And by the way, our fellow independent journalist Sloan Rackmuth points out that while we were all talking about Irina, we have a 22-year-old in Mecklenburg County recently arrested for first-degree burglary. And remember the number 22. He's 22 years old. 22 is also the number of prior arrests that he has had over just 7 years, including assault, strangulation, and intent to kill. Just, you know, minor stuff.
Look, in Chicago and these other liberal-run cities, the police do their job. They identify and they apprehend these people. It's liberal judges elected by the Democrats. It's Democrats electing liberal district attorneys. So the Democrats elect liberal city councils who put liberal policies in place. They elect liberal district attorneys who don't prosecute. They elect liberal judges who, you know, do cashless bail and give light sentences. So the Democrats are what's causing this problem. And by the way, most of the violence is created by Democrats. It's quite simple. Just ban Democrats. I mean, if you want to get rid of gun violence, just pass a law saying that Democrats can't own guns, and you'll get rid of 95% of the murders.
I think that's a brilliant idea. Well, the Democrats, of course, in Raleigh were beside themselves that such a bill was being considered. They had all kinds of excuses for ignoring the topic. Play clip four.
There's no one singular solution to the issues that caused that incident last month on the light rail in Charlotte. There's not one singular thing that could have prevented that issue.
Sure,
and there's not one singular thing in this bill that we're going to be voting on that would have prevented what happened.
Yes.
We are exacerbating the issues that caused us to have to pass the political violence bill. This is it right here. This is why this stuff happens.
And I would say this crime probably could not have been prevented.
Yes, it could have been kept the guy in jail.
For example, calling someone a monster is totally inappropriate.
Well, the dude was a monster. He just, like, murdered that girl.
Maybe monstrous, but the individual is not.
That's
a
difference without a distinction.
But Charlotte is not out of control.
Charlotte is
out
of control.
It was not out of control when I got there, and it's not out of control now.
Boy.
It just needs a little tender care.
Yeah,
it's
Chicago.
Just so mean. Just mean-spirited at this point, and I don't know why.
Well, I don't know. We don't like people murdering innocent people on Chicago's light rail. That's so mean that you take away cashless bail and you, like, you know, pass a law enforcement bill. That's mean.
I don't know who, you know, and again, I say this all the time. We can condemn and criticize these Democrat lawmakers, but remember, people vote for them too.
Right.
So they're not the only idiots in the equation here, and that's always worth keeping in mind. Speaking of left-wing idiocy, I delighted in seeing this headline this week out of the Mojave Desert in California. A solar power plant, which cost $2.2 billion to build between 2010 and 2014, is now scheduled to close next year after failing to efficiently generate what? Oh, yeah. Solar energy.
Yeah, imagine $2.2 billion.
$2.2 billion with a B.
That's a lot of fat stacks.
That is a lot. That is a lot of gambling money. That's a lot of walking around money.
So you know what else is in the news? If I could boldly
be so
interrupt.
Bold. Yes.
So locally, you know, all these solar farms you see around here. Locally, one of the largest solar farm operators in North Carolina laid off 500 employees, and they're shutting down. And they're trying to figure out what they're going to do with all their solar farms. They're trying to, like, sell them to some other company. All this stuff happened. You know, look, we said, gee, when all these subsidies stop for solar energy, what's going to happen to all these solar farms, right? Those things are giant, hazardous waste dumps just waiting to happen, right?
And
it's starting to happen.
Yeah.
All those solar panels, they have, like, heavy metals in them. Oh. They got RCM this and gallium that. And, I mean, I'm just making this up at this point. But those things are just, they're heavy metals, and it's going to be a problem. And they're already starting to go belly up, even in North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, this Mojave plant was not merely just inefficient and expensive. It was deadly for wildlife. The power plant is believed to be responsible for at least 6,000 bird deaths annually. That's a lot of wings.
Wonder how many spotted owls.
That's a lot of fowls.
So here was the scam in North Carolina, right? And everyone ought to be outraged. We should be marching on Raleigh. So what happened is the federal government gave all kinds of subsidies. You know, the left has got in, and they gave all kinds of subsidies to alternative energy. Then the North Carolina General Assembly passes a bill mandating Duke gets a certain percentage of their power from solar and wind. Then all these fly-by-night companies come in. They feed at the trough of federal money and, you know, grants and tax breaks and all this stuff. They buy cheap Chinese solar panels. They install them. Our utility rates go up 25 to 30%. not because Duke's greedy, but because, you know, the General Assembly mandated this crap. So then we pay Duke. So Duke has to buy this more expensive power. Everybody's making tons of money. The people who did these solar plants made tons of money. China made tons of money. The federal government subsidies come to an end. Those companies go belly up. They take their money and run. China made their money. Everybody made their money, except our utility bills are higher. Then we're going to have to deal with these decrepit solar farms 5 or 10 years down the road when they're leaking gallium oxide or God knows what's in solar panels. It's bad. Plus, you ever notice that there's no weeds growing in those solar farms?
Yeah, yeah.
You know how much Roundup and sodium glyphosate they must spray on that to keep the... I mean, those things are... But the liberals never mention the environmental hazards of any of this. 6,000 birds a year just for this one solar farm?
Yeah.
And the liberals will stand up and cheer, but God forbid they killed a whole logging industry in the Pacific Northwest, killed an entire industry to save a spotted owl.
Yeah, yeah. You can't make it up, killing the environment to save the environment.
It's insane.
It is insane. I want to shift gears real quickly because this is a delicious bit of data that came in the past week, which you got to love, from the State Board of Elections. Here's the headline. For the first time, like ever, Republican voter registration have topped 2.3 million in the state of North Carolina. And those unaffiliated with any party are going toward 3 million in total. But here's the killer for the Democrats. The Democrats' forever lead, meaning in voter registration over the Republicans, has dwindled to less than 1.5% of those registered, down to a scant 11,000 separating the two. This is unbelievable. Well, not unbelievable, but certainly a quantum shift. And by the way, it's happening in other states, too. For example, in Florida, in the past, call it 10 months, in the key voting county of Miami-Dade, the Democrats used to have a 2% edge on the Republicans in voter registration. Here today in September 2025, that has flipped to the Republicans holding a 3% advantage in voter registration in Miami-Dade. And overall in Florida, the advantage has risen from 7.8% Republican to 10% in, again, a period of just 10 months. And it's happening elsewhere. It's happening, of course, here in North Carolina. In Wake and Mecklenburg counties, the Democrat voter registration advantage is on the decline. Of course, they still have an edge, but it's declining. In Iowa, the same thing is happening, a key swing state as well. And down the roster you go. In terms of all the swing states, Republican voter registration is on the rise. And I have a feeling that as the successes of the Trump administration continue to build, and as we endure the tragedies of political violence imposed on us by the left, of course, bringing to mind Charlie Kirk, you will continue to see this this move to growing Republican voter registration. I mentioned Charlie. I'm sure many of you watched the memorial from Arizona, from the big football stadium in Glendale earlier in the week. Many of you may also have attended the vigil on the Village Green in Pinehurst, which was about 400 to 500 people gathered to honor the memory of this great patriot. I wanted to share with you, if you missed it, a particularly moving and also inspiring a delivery by senior presidential aide Stephen Miller, this from the Kirk Memorial in Arizona, play clip 5.
Erica is the storm. We are the storm. And our enemies cannot comprehend our strength, our determination, our resolve, our passion. Our lineage and our legacy hails back to Athens, to Rome, to Philadelphia, to Monticello. Our ancestors built the cities. They produced the art and architecture. They built the industry. Erica stands on the shoulders of thousands of years of warriors, of women, who raised up families, raised up city, raised up industry, raised up civilization, who pulled us out of the caves and the darkness into the light. The light will defeat the dark. We will prevail over the forces of wickedness and evil. They cannot imagine what they have awakened. They cannot conceive of the army that they have arisen in all of us. Because we stand for what is good, what is virtuous, what is noble. And to those trying to incite violence against us, those trying to foment hatred against us, what do you have? You have nothing. You are nothing. You are wickedness. You are jealousy. You are envy. You are hatred. You are nothing. You can build nothing. You can produce nothing. You can create nothing. We are the ones who build. We are the ones who create. We are the ones who lift up humanity.
And you know, that was just one of the many speakers, but I thought that was particularly powerful. And, you know, that's what we need. That's the spirit we need to stand up to the left in the era and the age in which we live.
Right, because the left, they don't want to just destroy America. They want to destroy the very concept that America was founded upon, which is Western civilization.
Dismantling and starting over. That's what they would love to do. There may be some people starting over employment-wise here soon. As you know, the drumbeat of fear is beginning to build that, oh, no, there's going to be a government shutdown because they can't get their act together up on Capitol Hill in D.C. to arrive at some kind of a budget to pay for the government. I've always thought that a government shutdown had a certain comforting effect to me anyway. But here's what they're planning to do at the Office of Management and Budget in Washington, which is run by Russ Voigt. But his wingman up there is former North Carolina Congressman Dan Bishop. They're planning, in the event of a government shutdown, instead of just furloughing, they're going to just eliminate the jobs. It would be a significant break from how these shutdowns have been handled in recent decades, when most furloughs were temporary and employees were brought back once Congress voted to reopen. But this time, the OMB director is using the threat of permanent job cuts as leverage.
That is so awesome.
Upping the ante in the standoff with Democrats in Congress. Let's see the Democrats own that, okay? Because we know that all these jobs are out there are called non-essential. Well, if they are, get rid of them.
If they're non-essential, just don't report back to work.
It's very simple. Other people who are going to be out of jobs soon are these annoying Starbucks employees, by the way. Starbucks this past week announced a major restructuring. They're going to fire 900 corporate employees. They're going to start shutting down a lot of their coffee shops. And I think this is, you know, maybe the long overdue. We're not going to take it anymore when it comes to Starbucks.
We should pass a law against, while we're at it, just pumpkin spice should be outlawed. Just pumpkin spice at all. I don't care. Beer, bread, cookies, no pumpkin spice.
I'm in. A reminder, coming up next, we're brewing a riveting conversation with Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation, who is coming to Pinehurst on October the 8th as part of the Holzhauser Speaker Series. He will be making a presentation talking about his forthcoming book, The Polarization Myth. If you want to buy tickets, go to jhspeakerseries.com, jhspeakerseries.com. Our guest this morning is Jonathan Butcher of the Washington, D.C.-based Heritage Foundation, where he is the acting director of the Center for Education Policy and a senior research fellow in education policy. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And for those of us who have long relied on the Heritage Foundation for intel and policy guidance and whatnot, Jonathan is a longtime Heritage Foundation foot soldier. His time with the organization goes all the way back to 2002 when he was a college age guy, and after going to graduate school in Arkansas, he went back to Heritage and has been there since 2017. So we thank you for all the great work that you and your colleagues do at the Heritage Foundation, no question about it. And for those of you who have followed the evolution of critical race theory seeping into and poisoning our culture and the educational system, I can refer you to Jonathan's book published in 2022 entitled Splintered, Critical Race Theory and the Progressive War on Truth. And boy, is that on the money. So I highly recommend all of you to check that book out on CRT, which I think is starting to get closer to being DOA, but I guess we'll find out. Jonathan will be here in Pinehurst on October the 8th, a featured speaker in the as part of the Governor James E. Holzhauser Speaker Series. That will be October 8th at the Country Club of North Carolina. You can go to the Holzhauser Speaker Series website to learn about ticket availability, and we encourage you to do so and to let all of your conservative friends and family members know that Jonathan is coming our way on October the 8th. I believe that'll be a 6 p.m. Event at the Country Club of North Carolina. Where he will be discussing his forthcoming book, a very timely one indeed, entitled The Polarization Myth, America's Surprising Consensus on Race, Schools, and Sex. That book will be released in early December, so in a few months, but you can order it right now, pre-order it at Amazon.com, and this is going to be must reading. And actually, Jonathan, as we are talking today, we are sadly not very many days removed from the assassination of our brother Charlie Kirk. And I guess there are those who would point to that event as clear evidence that we could not be a more polarized nation, to the point where one side is willing to kill one of our best and brightest voices in the cause of freedom and in the defeat of socialism and Marxism. But that being said, tell us what we're going to learn when we read your book. And it's very encouraging to know that the polarization the left-wing media hammers away on all the time may in fact be just a narrative.
Well, we keep getting told that America is divided on everything. And I think politically that may be true when we see, you know, how close a presidential election may be, or when we look at different elections around the country, even when people are polled and asked what they think about members of Congress or how Congress is doing. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that there actually are pretty low marks for our elected officials. But when you look at the issues, when we talk about the actual policies or the cultural movements that are happening in the United States, it's remarkable how Americans actually agree. In fact, the very subject that Charlie Kirk was talking about at the time of the tragic murder was an issue that actually there is not polarization on the issue of, quote, choosing your own gender. Americans widely, in fact, believe that there are only two sexes, right? Male and female. The numbers from the polling on that are pretty clear. The same goes for allowing boys to use girls' private spaces, you know, that is locker rooms and bathrooms, or have boys participate in girls' athletics. Parents don't want these things. The general public doesn't like these things. And so my book walks through a nationally representative survey that finds, right, that there is actually opposition to these issues on promoting gender in schools and elsewhere. But that's not all. We also find widespread agreement on issues of racial preferences in things like college admissions and elsewhere, as well as education. And we find that there is widespread dissatisfaction, I think, with the public school system at large.
So what, in your research and in, and when you were surveying these 2,000 citizens, what was the one most, I guess I would say, surprising a piece of evidence that you found that, in fact, that in fact supports the polarization myth theory of the case?
Well, I think the data found that we Americans don't like the idea that schools use racial preferences in admissions. They don't like the idea that students would be admitted to school based on the color of their skin. In fact, we asked in our survey for opinions on that issue, as well as what do Americans think should be used for measuring, you know, whether or not a student should go off to a particular college. And over again, the results have come back that they like, you know, the idea of using GPA and standardized tests, measures of merit, right, about how prepared students are to go off into higher education. But it wasn't just our survey, right? I mean, one survey can give you a snapshot of a moment in time, which is why it was not just a op-ed about a survey. I wrote a book because there are actually quite a bit, quite a few surveys that find the same results. Pew, for example, Pew Research has found similar results showing that Americans don't like the use of racial preferences in education. The same goes for this idea of gender. The New York Times, of all places, found in a survey that Americans don't want young people taught about the idea of gender, especially pre-K and elementary school.
Also, looking beyond education, you know, one of the current themes that unfortunately is sort of in our face is the what you might call the good versus evil polarization problem in this country. The love of country versus the wanting to dismantle it, the belief that that America is systemically racist and irredeemable, the idea that we are polarized because on the right we do not hesitate to intertwine our Christianity with our politics. In fact, I heard somebody say that the success of Charlie Kirk was that he didn't bring politics to his Christianity, but in fact Christianity to his politics. And then the other side, which of course is the left, which denounces thoughts and prayers and any type of fundamental religious foundation as a point of reference for why we love our country and why America's founding is unlike any in the world. Is there also less of that? In other words, are there more closet people who are patriots than we know about?
I think so. I mean, it really breaks down to civics, right? And when it comes to how this actually is discussed in politics, in policy, in the White House. In fact, the White House is just now launching an initiative to celebrate the 250th of the United States next year. Mm-hmm. And as a part of that, they are, you know, talking a lot about how civics is being taught around the country. Now, of course, Washington should not create a new curriculum that is to be mandated. That's up to states. However, it is a vantage point from which Washington can say, we should give young people something to aspire to. And we can give young people something to look back in our history and find as individuals as role models, right? And in the world of civics, you have two camps. You have the action civics camp, and then you have the traditional civics camp. And under the Obama administration in particular, but also under the Biden administration, the action civics adherents really won out. And they push this idea that young people should be trained to be activists. They should be trained to stage walkouts, to lobby their state lawmakers, even federal lawmakers, for particular causes. Now, the problem, of course, with that is that young people, they simply don't have the training or the understanding or the basis of knowledge on which to take nuanced positions when that's necessary on these issues. And, you know, their minds are being shaped, their perspectives are being shaped by these ideas like critical race theory, diversity, equity, and inclusion, these ideas that say America, as you mentioned, is systemically racist, or that we are part of an identity groups and our identity politics matters more than anything else. I think what the Trump administration, and I think what states like Florida, Louisiana, South Dakota, now Texas, what these places are doing are developing standards that are based on teaching young people that the United States has a unique place in world history when it comes to liberty and freedom, and a representative government based on the rule of law. These are core ideas at the center of the history and social studies standards in those states. And then when you teach about our founding fathers, when you teach about those who had significant roles in American history, we cannot define them by their mistakes and shortcomings. That is simply an unfair way to look at any history, right? Is to simply take the mistakes that people made and have that define them. Instead, we can talk about what made Abraham Lincoln an example of, right, the great American success story, coming from poverty and or coming from, you know, living in a log cabin and then becoming president of the United States. The same is true with George Washington, who really didn't have any formal education beyond the early years, but worked his way up to become ultimately our first president. And on down the line, I mean, you can pick any number of individuals who they are being tarnished by school leaders today who refuse to name schools after them. Or for schools named after them, they want to change the names to something else.
Yeah.
Or they want to teach in the curriculum that they own slaves, in the case of Washington, is what really defines them. And in fact, it's not only more complicated than that, it's actually more discouraging to leave out the good things that they did and why we should revere them.
And I think it's interesting in the realm of education how we are seeing young people, especially high school and college age males, moving toward a more conservative worldview, and in big numbers, to the point that it undoubtedly affected the last presidential election in a big way for President Trump. And yet that, of course, scares the left to death. And so what do? They're doubling down on diversity, equity, and inclusion. They're just renaming it things like access advocacy and other buzzwords that I'm seeing. How is DEI doing? Are they starting to become irrelevant despite their determination to hang on?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? They're inserting words like belonging and tolerance, right, into the names of DEI offices, or what once were known as DEI offices. I can say that in a report that I just released at Heritage with my colleague Mike Gonzalez, we looked at the colleges and even K-12 systems around the country that are disguising their DEI programs, just as you described. I would say last week we received news that Clemson closed their DEI office after our report was released. We are very pleased to learn that. Now, of course, there's more going on at Clemson these days with what appears to be the firing of the two professors and the staff employee over what they tweeted regarding Charlie Kirk. But, you know, I think for the institution to make a move like that, it does represent, I think, what schools around the country are feeling. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. We have to be very clear what this actually is. It is the administrative application of critical race theory. Critical race theory is the belief that the world can only be understood in terms of racial differences, right? And even the critical race theorists themselves, that's how they define it, right? They define themselves as Marxists and radicals who want to interpret American law and American culture in terms of racial differences, and racism defines the American experience. DEI operationalizes that belief, and it does so by promoting enrollment policies that are based on the color of a student's skin, policies that require an individual to write a DEI statement before they're hired or before they're enrolled, among private companies, having quotas for the races of individuals who are hired. These are all the things that DEI offices and DEI employees have advocated for over the years. Fortunately, in 2023, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that DEI, the use of racial preferences in college admissions, was unconstitutional, but they took it a step further, and they said DEI is representative of something bigger, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but I can directly say that Chief Justice Roberts said, look, if you want to get rid of discrimination anywhere, you have to get rid of it everywhere. And I think that that is a clear signal that they understand that DEI is being applied across the board in business, in education, in government, as ways to rebalance the scales based on essentially racial favoritism. And this is very harmful to society. It violates the spirit as well as the intent, as well as the way that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is applied. So I think colleges are on the retreat with this in the way that state lawmakers are prohibiting the use of taxpayer spending on DEI offices.
Yeah, the light is shining in the dark corners of these institutions. Jonathan, I would like to thank you for engaging us in this enlightening conversation. We've been talking to Jonathan Butcher, Acting Director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation and a Senior Research Fellow in Education Policy with the Heritage Foundation. He is coming to Pinehurst on October the 8th. He will be speaking at the Country Club of North Carolina as part of the Holzhauser Speaker Series. Visit the Holzhauser Speaker Series website to secure your tickets. And Jonathan, we thank you, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
We want to thank everybody for joining us once again as part of your Saturday and joining us for a thorough review of all the crazy in the world. I am Steve Woodward. David Hensley, thank you for joining us as always.
Yes, sir.
We look forward to putting together another big, big show for you next week. We are here at 11 a.m. every Saturday exclusively on WEEB AM and FM. Please join us. I'm Steve. He's David. And we'll be here again next time.
Taking Aim.